Sometimes you meet someone who reminds you of how curious you used to be, who reminds you that rocks can be really cool, that sea slugs deserve fan clubs, and that awe isn't something we have to grow out of, and it's something that we can grow back into. Today's guest is Emily Hunter, an environmental educator and guide currently based on the Ningaloo Reef in Australia. She's a hiker, snorkeler, bushwalker, sea slug census goer, and the creative force behind EnviroEd with M. But more than that, Emily is someone who wakes up every day and makes being curious look easy, natural. She spent her life connecting people to the world around them, from Idaho to Tasmania to Western Australia. And she's got stories about leading hikes at sunrise, about finding community when it doesn't already exist, and about turning that little spark of wow into action. This is a conversation about interpretation, not just in the park ranger sense, but in the soul of SciComm sense, about what it means to be a translator of wonder. This is The Wildlife. I'm Devin Boker. Let's meet Emily.
Hey, my name is Emily Hunter. I use she, her pronouns, and I am an environmental science educator.
How did she get here?
Oh man, where to even start?
The academic end, she earned her bachelor's in environmental science and management in 2020.
Woo woo!
Emphasis in education and interpretation. But before that,
I was born and raised in Idaho. And if you're familiar with the good old potato state, it is more on the conservative side of things. And I would say that environmental science, and especially environmental education, tends to not be a thing of great focus in that part of the world. And when I was younger, I remember being at school and always being referred to as, oh, the tree hugger and the hippie and this and that. At the time, I guess, just caring a lot about, you know, in whatever 2015, it would be like, save the polar bears and like, save the turtles.
An early feeling of being out of place for caring too much. That's a story that I've heard over and over, especially from people working in science and advocacy. It's one that I've lived with for my entire life, but Emily didn't shrink from it. She leaned in and went searching for answers.
And since then, having that evolved into a much more, I guess, intersectional environmental approach to things. But it kind of started from there. It started from way back, just caring a lot about this thing that I felt we all should care about and not having that be reciprocated and wanting to find answers. So I pursued that degree and went to school in California because I wanted answers to all the questions I had. And I was like, what actually is happening to the world? What actually is this global warming business? And how can I understand this data? So I went to find the answers to like be able to tell people back home and to be able to more or less like have comebacks at family dinner parties and all of that. And since then, it's blossomed into this really unique and eclectic career, which has led me to have random roles in different places across the world now. So all the way from California, and I've since moved more or less spontaneously / by accident to Australia and have found really similar roles that I love and that feel my passions in the land down under. So yeah.
I always say that science in general, not even just biology, but science in general is like the best. If you have existential anxiety, it's like a feedback loop. It's like, oh, I'm going to go find the answers to all the things that I'm like anxious about and I want to know about, I want to understand how they work. And then you get answers, but then there's more questions that come up with those answers. And then it just kind of perpetuates for forever. Yeah. It never quite stops. But you mentioned, so like the emphasis is in, you've got the education and the interpretation piece. And I feel like there's a lot of people who don't really know what that means when we talk about environmental science or biology, when we say interpretation. Yeah. What does that mean? And how do you think that that kind of approach, that lens has shaped, I guess, the lens that you now?
Oh my gosh, I love it. Okay, so I think it was first year of undergrad. And I remember going through all of the core classes, as you know, as you will. And then your advisor's like, okay, you want to choose this degree. But within this degree, for me, there were like 7 different emphases within environmental science and management. So we had things like energy and climate. We had my degree, the education and interpretation side of things. There was policy. There was a few more that are slipping in mind. And I chose the education and interpretation side because I had an epiphany one day when in the deep depths of data analyzing, when I was like, oh my gosh, there is so much data that already exists. There are so many bizarre studies and information galore that exists, but all that information is locked away into these little echo chambers of the internet and these like scientific papers. And then even then, many scientific journals and whatnot, you have to pay for, or they're tricky to access and they're filled with jargon and they're filled with a bunch of hibbly blobbly that like most people don't understand. And not even most people, even though the peers of those scientists take like weeks for them to understand those studies. And so for me, I was like, I could either go the route of more data collection, go the route of choosing something really niche and studying that and getting really passionate about that thing. But I was like full on stopped in my tracks. Like, what's the point if all this information goes nowhere? If like all these scientists are already existing here and across the world collecting all this data, and then that data just gets put to a stop in like an imaginary dam wall of information. And it's like, I was just like, what? We gotta do something about this. We gotta, you know, like take this information that's already existing. Go from there. And so the education interpretation side, it's taking these really complicated kind of hoobly blobbly, as I was saying, concepts or information and data, and like siphoning it or rewording it or reimagining it in a way that everyone can understand. And it's an art form, actually, really. It's about like taking something and kind of recreating it. And the interpretation side in my degree focused a little bit on the kind of digital side. So imagine if you walk to a park and they're like, welcome to this park. And it may have a little pictures of some species or some information or a map. That's kind of in the interpretation side of what I would do. So like kind of the sign map creation side of things. And also if you go to in the States, we have lovely NPS, National Park Service System. So you may be greeted by like a ranger or someone who was there to deliver interpretive talks or kind of talk to you about the area. So that's kind of interpretation side of it. And the education side of it, dealing more with typically school kids, after school programs, in school programs, that sort of thing, kind of more embedded into the education system side of environmental science.
While some people are out chasing the next data point, Emily is chasing connection. And the way that she talks about it, it doesn't feel like a job. It feels like a responsibility, a kind of gentle rebellion against a world that so often feels indifferent and callous.
Yeah. And so it's so important. I wanted to elaborate on the interpretive piece because like it, there's kind of like the two pieces there. So I was a naturalist for a state park, and I was a park ranger for a federal agency. And you know, your job title is like interpretive naturalist. And then when you tell people, like, they're like, what do you do? Like, I'm an interpretive naturalist. I'm like, what are you interpreting? I'm like, so many things, the land, you know, the different animals, like, you know, everything kind of speaks in its own language. And your job is to kind of, you know, at least on that side of things, is to kind of figure out what is being said through the land and through the bird song or whatever it might be. But then there is, of course, yeah, like you mentioned, the interpretation of big word science, which is always so funny to me because every like practicing scientist that I know, they don't like day-to-day speak that way, right? Like they have to go through hours and hours and hours of like trying to make their paper sound complicated only for people to have to try and simplify it. Like, what? Hello? It doesn't make a lot of sense. It drives me crazy. Because, you know, it creates this, like, it just widens that divide even more. People thinking that, like, science is a big ivory tower. It's impenetrable. They can't do it either. And it's just weird. It's ridiculous. But, I feel like I've been saying it in so many conversations lately. So I, like, don't want to be so repetitive, but I can't help it because it's just resonating. The idea, and it's been quoted by so many different people, but, like, the idea that, like, in order to care about something, you have to learn about it first. And in order to protect something, you have to care about it first, which means you had to learn about it first. Well, if all the information out there is locked up in overly complicated research papers, and how are you ever going to care about it? And if you can't care about it, then how are you ever going to protect it? So the kind of work that you do is vital, you know, and making that kind of stuff happen. So that's awesome. Yeah.
Knowledge is power. Like, that is the key. Like,
yeah,
exactly. You have hits a nail on the head, man. Again, I know what you mean. It sounds cliche and blah, blah, but, like, it absolutely is. And I've had the great fortune and privilege of being in roles to be, like, the bridge and be kind of that connector piece between people, whether it's kids as young as, like, kindergartners, all the way up into, like, people in their 80s and 90s in the last couple of years, and, like, being with them in natural environments and either going on walks with them or doing scientific experiments with them, or, like, simply just existing out in nature together and having people reconnect on a really simple level with the world around them is, like, that first piece. And while knowledge is power, like, the precursor to that is also being open to awe and curiosity.
Now, I've got to say, that line floored me. The precursor to knowledge is awe? Like, what the f***? Like, that's the spark, the unlock, the thing that comes before the science textbook ever even gets opened. Awe, curiosity, wonder. You know what? I'm just going to stop interrupting for a while because, like, it's just too good. Emily is just too good.
And, like, it's just like if you were sitting at, like, a boring lecture and it's just, like, knowledge, knowledge, knowledge. And it's like, okay, like, if it's dull and boring and plain and you don't care about it and you're not curious about it, it's just going to, like, wash over your membranes. But if you're like, oh, I'm actually, like, kind of curious. Oh, this kind of intrigues me. And you have a sense of interest or awe about something, you're also going to be more receptive to that knowledge. And that knowledge is going to, like, permeate a bit. And it's going to, like, you know, so we have to, the step before knowledge is also connection, you know? And, like, for me, my work, like, so I've worked, like I've stayed with you before, just out of university, I went and worked with an AmeriCorps program called the Watershed Stewards Program in California. Go salmon. I could go all the way into salmon and how cool they are and all of that. But we'll put a pinhole in that. And then after that, going to work San Francisco as an environmental science educator. So working with folks from the Bay Area and having them come to our campus for 3 to 5 days. And getting to engage with kids in this outdoor scene for several days. So epic. And then I came to Australia with the intention of a 2-month holiday, and it's been 2 years and I haven't left. But then I've had the chance to work as a bushwalking guide down in Tasmania, traversing mountains and beaches with folks who, you know, maybe don't have the strength or means to, like, carry full overnight packs for themselves, and going kayaking with people for the very first time and snorkeling with people for the very first time in my role now up in the Ningaloo in Western Australia. And all of those experiences, like, have been at their core about getting people reconnected or deepening their own personal connection with nature in some way or form or another, in whatever unique way that looks like for that individual.
Yeah. You know, That's the part that I try because so I teach high school like during the school year and stuff, and, like, that's the element that I feel like is so missing in a lot of the way that, like, even just primary education and stuff is done. Is, you know, when you are a naturalist or a guide or a ranger or, you know, in some kind of role like that where your job is that communication and that interpreting is like, you don't have a captive audience. Like, they can walk away or not show up, or, you know, if they get really bored, they can just completely tune out, disappear, go do their own thing. So like, you really have to figure out like range of age. You know, you could have people like in their toddlers to retirement and beyond, all in the same thing with you. And so you really have to figure out like, how am I going to take this thing with this diverse crowd in front of me, make it connect with each individual one of them, and make sure that they have that kind of experience where they are experiencing wonder and it's connecting to, you know, some important part of their experience. And that is so key. Like, that whole piece is so key, just in the overall education piece, like, you know, bringing that into the classroom and stuff as well. You know, how do you make sure that, you know, it's not just the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. You know, how do you connect on a deeper level with every individual? Yeah, that's definitely powerful. And that is a really wide range of stuff. It's awesome to have such kind of a plethora of experiences in your background. I mean, do you have one that was maybe your favorites, or any like really standout experiences that come to mind?
Okay, favorite. I've got an issue with the word favorite, because I feel like it compares everything else to have to be like a number one, or like it ranks them all, then makes all the other experiences like lesser. They're all, you know, unique in their own way. But like, in the sense that like each of those roles that I've had have all been really special for me in those periods of life. And I would say impactful to different degrees. There's a vast difference between, you know, going to the beach with a group of BIPOC students in the Bay Area who've never seen the ocean before, have lived in California their whole life, and are like, you know, afraid to sit on the sand to get their, like, you know, their clothes dirty, and then working at an eco safari lodge here in the Ningaloo with like people with lots and lots of money and taking them snorkeling. And it's like, they're very different, and I appreciate them all for the uniqueness of like what they've been able to offer me as far as places to experience. But favorite, I don't know. I mean, I could go on and on about different stories that I've had for sure in like at each spot, but I think like even today, got to take a group of 12 folks out on a beautiful snorkel. And if you've ever been snorkeling, which I hadn't had any ocean experience as well until like later in my life. I'm from Idaho, let's not forget that. But when, if you ever have like something in your mouth and you're like excited, or you like see something, it's a lot of your side. And like cyber grumbles and like screams and like people pointing and just like being so stoked on like the littlest fish and like all the colors in the underwater world. And I can't help but just like be filled up with like just excitement and just like love and feeling good after a day bringing people out onto a beautiful part of the world. Getting to do that is such a privilege, you know?
I've only snorkeled one time. I'm so afraid of water. Like, I'm pathetic with it. Like, I went in, I was like terrified because like, I can't see the bottom. And it was like 20 feet deep. It wasn't even that horrible. But it was a really, really cool experience. I really want to do it again. I just got to get near the ocean again at some point. So like, you do that. You're a nature guide at the Ningaloo Reef, which is really, really cool. I mean, what does a typical day look like? What are the things you kind of see? Is there consistent stuff that you see on a day to day, or is it kind of touch and go?
Yeah, great question. I have got hired on. Yeah, this is a part of Western Australia that's quite remote. Perth is the most remote capital city in the world, and I'm about 14-hour drive north of that. So we out here, as they say, and the staff they hire are pretty much all arounders. So we all kind of do a little bit of everything, do a little bit of, you know, kind of the front of house work, hospitality stuff, this and that. And on my lucky days, I get to be a guide and go out and point at turtles and go on hikes and all of that good stuff. So today, for example, I woke up at about 5 o'clock and got myself ready to go on a sunrise hike with our guests. So we took them up to a place called Mandu Mandu, just around the corner from where I'm at. And we do a little bit of star talk in the very early morning before the sun rises up and traverse them safely up on it through the trails and do a lot of interpreting. So not just language interpreting, but interpreting of the trees and of the rocks and of the sky and the land and the sea about what we see and kind of what's happened there in the past, and do some of the talking for those things that can't talk. We've got a lot of rock wallabies, black-flanked rock wallabies that inhabit those areas, and some incredible natural history and geologic history in Australia. That I don't know, have the time to get into all of it, but absolutely thrilling stuff. And then the salvo for afternoon, some Aussie slang slipping in there, salvo. And this afternoon we went down to a lovely beach called Turquoise Bay and did some drift snorkeling around and talked about the different species that we were seeing, and went on a little hunt for some butterfly fish and turtles and all the fun stuff. Yeah, that's on a good day. Get to have some fun in the water and get out there and allow the guests to experience a really unique part of the world.
That sounds like a perfect kind of day. That just sounds amazing. In Australia, oh my gosh, I want to go so bad. I'm looking at maybe doing a class, like a student trip thing, but it wouldn't be until like 2026. It's a while away, but I don't know. Total dream right there.
Yeah,
especially just the brief areas and stuff too. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, so you've got the Great Barrier Reef, which I'm sure mm-hmm. yourself and most people listening have heard of before, but the Ningaloo Reef is an equally incredible reef. It's not so there's barrier reefs and fringing reefs, and the Ningaloo Reef is a fringing reef, which these are just terms given to discuss or to say how far away the reef is from the shore. So fringing reef is much, much closer to the shore, and this makes it really accessible. So you can just like strap on your mask and waddle out and boom, you're in the reef in like a few feet, versus a Great Barrier Reef, you have to get in a boat and like drive for quite a ways off the shore to get into. So people say that the Ningaloo Reef is actually, I hate superlatives, not better. There's no better or worse reef. But it is a much more accessible, I think is a fair thing to say, accessible reef than the Great Barrier Reef. Which makes it pretty, pretty epic to live so close by. Yeah.
So there's obviously been a lot of changes with reefs and things. This last year in particular was kind of a rough year for reefs. I mean, do you see that with the Ningaloo, or is it doing relatively okay, or how does it appear to be holding up in spite of, you know, all of...
Great question. I would also love to know. So I have been up here for just about a month and a half. So I haven't been able to see, per se, the seasonal changes and compare and contrast years of comparison of what the reef may or may not have looked like in years prior.
Sure.
However, I did just get back a few hours ago from a science night at the community center. They did a Science of Ningaloo talk. There is the Australian Institute of Marine Biology and the Antarctic Institute. I wrote it in my notes somewhere. But anyways, these two gals are lovely talks. One about whale sharks, which don't even get me started. Super cool. Largest fish in the sea. They're not really sharks or really whales, but they're fish. And also about humpback whales tonight. And kind of touched a little bit on like reef health as well. But really this reef several years ago did see a pretty good bleaching event happen, and it has since recovered dramatically. And the thing is that the reef here in particular has a lot of cold water swell coming up into its northern waters. The way that the swell direction comes up, it's pretty much straight shot from Antarctica. So luckily in this area, it tends to not have as much of a impact as the Great Barrier Reef has had in similar years. So it's got a little bit of a buffer zone, and scientists are actually looking at using coral samples and like polyps per se for repopulating other areas that are maybe less healthy. So it's all ever changing. And coral is so cool. It's an animal. It's like people are like, it kind of looks like a plant because it's like a planty and it's like stuck in one spot. It's got to be a plant. It's an animal. Oh my gosh. Just that fact alone, we'd all just got to sit with that for a minute. Like,
yeah, one of the things that I started this last year was, so in my classroom, we have a 125 gallon saltwater tank. And so we're slowly working on trying to build it up as a reef system. And just like all the little intricacies that go into that and the little subtleties of balance and things. And then of course, you know, you're trying to introduce corals and things, which are so touchy. And then kids are always like, you sure that thing is alive? You sure that's an animal? And I'm like, yeah. And I look at the, you know, like the little tentacles and things, and they're just like, no, I don't think that's right. I'm like, yeah. And we look at the anatomy diagrams and they're just like, but what about those hard ones? Like what? And yeah, they're just so wacky.
That's
really
cool.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And like sponges, you know, sponges are a whole other one. Yeah. Where it's just like, they can be so cool and diverse. I mean, like glass sponges, like deep sea sponges made out of glass. And like some of them can live for like 10,000 years. Like that's insane. Like there are glass sponges in the deep Arctic Ocean that were alive when people were crossing the Bering Strait. Like that's nuts. But you know, no one cares about sponges. Sponges are just a plant. Like, no, it's not.
Someone alarm the bells. Everyone needs to know. Support the corals. They're not plants. They're not just plants, guy. Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. Slight tangent, but on this note of ocean curiosity, because as we all know, what is like the fact, our like space is more known than our oceans, or we know more about space than about our own oceans, you know, right? Like we all kind of heard that before. I had this thought the other day. You know how when, if you're like ever gandering up at the night sky and you see a few stars, if you're lucky enough to live in a place with like little light pollution, and you're like, wow, the universe, you know, it's one of the great things that makes us human, I think, is that like, again, thank you, cognitive revolution, but like the sense of being awestruck and like having curiosity. And I think for me, I had this epiphany the other day. I was walking on the beach and I was looking at shells, and I was like so full of curiosity and wonder. I was like, where did you come from? Oh, how long have you been here? Oh my gosh, like what is this journey of the shell been? And I was like, shells are like the stars of the oceans. They're just like kind of like our little gateway of like, you know, of intrigue and curiosity and wonder. And so, yeah, big fan of the ocean. And also that to say that I think the more that we fill our lives with those little moments of like, whoa, you know, we're like, whoa, that's kind of cool. I think the more like of a rich life we will all have. Like, imagine a world if we like all walked around with like an open-minded sense of curiosity and just like awe of the things around us. And then I just like to sit back and sometimes imagine what that world would be like. And I think that'd be pretty cool.
Oh, 100%. I mean, we all have that. Like when we're kids, we all have it. Like, you know, the stage of children where they never stop asking why. You know, and at some point people just like stop or like don't allow themselves to feel that or ask those questions anymore. And it's like, that's such a shame, you know, like you're so right. It's just that ability to be curious, that ability to wonder, and then also like to chase that and like to allow yourself to kind of have the feelings too of like, wow, this is so cool. And like actually get hyped about it and not be like, example, people are going to think it's weird if I think this rock is neat, you know, like,
think
the thing is neat. Yeah. 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 It's like, it's perfectly fine to be excited about those things and to chase that and follow, like, have your weird thing. It's okay. Like, weird isn't like weird. Weird isn't a bad thing. Weird is.
We all like, if just a thing. Had, oh my God, this is literally what I'm like the most confident about in the world. If everyone had their own little weird thing, we've all got them. I know if you're listening, you've got a weird thing that you're like, I kind of think this is cool, but I don't want to know anyone to know what you know about it. Like, it's your dirty little passionate secret. That is the thing that you should be like hyping up, getting intrigued about, filling up with curiosity. I don't care if it's rocks. I don't care if it's soil or like pelts or water or whatever it is. Like, filling our world up with just, yeah, passion is, I think, one of like the most critical things in our current society that we need to bring on this, like, bring back and like encourage the weirdness in all of us, like, encourage us to be like, you know, yeah, filled with whatever it is that, you know, lights you up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which kind of gave me an idea. I don't want to take it though. I don't know if I'll do it. I don't know. I had an idea for a maybe potential. I used to do like these daily like gratitude things, like a video series on like daily gratitude. I would just kind of like, what if instead of like daily gratitude, which is a good thing, but if it was like things that were neat today, I was like, ooh, that's cool. Which, speaking of, you also do videos. We're the EnviroEd with M. Yes. On Instagram. Yeah. What got you started doing that, and what's your like how do you come up with your ideas and what it is that you post? What's your process like, if you have one? I don't.
Yeah, big nerd alert and proud of it. Yeah. So Environmental Evidence, I think, was a long time passion project that's been brewing. It's been a pot that's been brewing in the back of my brain, because I had a lot of people say, well, Emily, like, either you should like write a book, or you should do something with this passion that you've got for life, you know, you should write this down, or start a podcast, hey, good on you, Devin, or do something. And that idea hadn't really come into light until recently. I had a friend of mine who was like, I think it'd be really cool if you started getting into reels, like post this stuff. Like, I shamelessly have so many videos on my phone of just plants and like of things and like birds. And I'm like, oh, look at this. And I just started filming it because I'm like, I think that thing is cool. But I had all this B-roll footage of all of this like stuff, like all of these things that I was like, oh, I'm going to take a picture of this so I can look it up later, you know? And then I started like going through my phone and I was like, so much footage. I could easily make a couple little reels. And as I'm learning about these things, like for my own excitement and knowledge, like, why don't we just share that? You know, I mean, how fun is that? It seems like a fun little hobby. And so I just started doing that. And honestly, the Environmental Ed with M has only just begun. Like, only in the last, I guess, couple months even, I've really been posting things on it, like in a semi-serious matter, in a way of like, you know, not just like, you know, once a blue moon, but trying to do them quite frequently. And it's something that being up here on the Ningaloo Reef has kind of really inspired me and taken a hold of. Like, I've got so much, I guess, content around me at the moment as far as like the beauty of the oceans and its uniqueness. So just trying to like lean into that. But yeah, it was born of just like being interested myself and having my own curiosities that I then wanted to share with whomever wanted to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's, because I make videos like too, but there's for sure like a place for that kind of thing. Cause not, like you kind of mentioned it a little bit ago, not everyone can get out, you know, to some of these really amazing places, or has the ability to go and see some really cool things. I mean, there's certainly nature everywhere, right? Like, you step out a door, you're in nature in some capacity. There's stuff. But there's something to be said about the power that social media has for being able to like share that interpretive message and stuff on a larger mm-hmm. scale and with more people, expose them to the world in a way that they might not have experienced before. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I had one of my friends from back home in Idaho's like mom comment on one of my reels, and she said, like, 56-year-old Idahoan here, would love to learn more about the ocean, please do more. And I'm just like, that's it, that is all the inspiration I needed, thank you, Jennifer. It's just like so sweet.
That's obviously like a big positive. Have you had any moments where like, his comment sections can be just ridiculous sometimes. Have you had any moments where people have been like, I hate the ocean, or like, I don't know, I can't even think of anything right now, but where people are just like calling into like, oh, that's not important, or like want to argue about it or anything like that yet? Any like the negative?
Honestly,
stuff?
No, not yet. Not no. yet. I don't think I've had the root for that thankfully yet. But I've seen it, like, you know, I receive and get recommended all of the environmental, similar naturalist kind of things. And you definitely see that mm-hmm. stuff for sure. But yeah. I think it's also motivating as well, because I'm just like, you know, even more reason to share the love. Mm-hmm. And because all it is just like, again, going back to that curiosity, that sense of interest and excitement. All it is just like, fun tidbits and information. Like, if you're salty about that, then like, get off the internet. What you doing? You know, go sit down and do something else. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't want to ask favorite, but okay. Yeah. So maybe a different word other than favorite. So,
something I've enjoyed.
Particular natural spots, places that you've been that like hold an extra special place in your heart that you find are, you know, inspiring to you, inspiring in the work that you do, maybe inspire, you know, the videos and the kind of content that you make, like that maybe a little bit more than others, not favorite, not better, but a little bit more.
So I used to have this saying, I don't know if I used to, I still do. My favorite dog is the dog I've most recently pet. I think we can all kind of attest to that. Like, you know, my favorite like dog in that moment is the dog that I am petting. You know what I mean? And I think that translates as well to like natural spots and the beauty that I'm in that moment. Like, I don't know. I feel like feel like really happy with my outlook on where I am at the time, whether it's just like being present or the ability to just like appreciate something for what it is. I think it's a skill, and I think it's really important. So yeah, sure, I've sat underneath Half Dome and gandered up at the granite rocks, and I've, you know, sat in temperate rainforests and looked up at the trees and, you know, all of the abundance in spectacular parts of the world, snorkeled in reefs and scuba dive the Great Barrier Reef, and like, yeah, sure, I felt awe in those moments, absolutely. And I also choose to see awe every, like, literally every day. Like the other day, the sunrise was so spectacular. I was like, I don't think I've ever seen anything more beautiful in my entire life than the sunrise right now. Like, this is so cool. I got everyone out of the kitchen. I was like, guys, you gotta check this out right now. This is like the most important thing like happening in the universe in this moment is the sunrise, right? And like, same thing, we get a lot of the humpback whales are migrating north. And so we get quite a few humpbacks out there breaching and dancing around out in the ocean. Every time I see one, take my breath away. I've seen probably hundreds, maybe even thousands at this point. Every time I'm like, oh my gosh, oh, I'm so humpback. And it's like, you know what I mean? Like, every day I find something. I like, it's not like I'm necessarily going out to seek it. Like, I'm waking up in the morning and I'm like, what's gonna inspire me today? Like, I gotta go seek it out. It just, you know, just happens around. And I think that also attests to the fact that like, no matter where you are in the world, whether you are in small town Idaho somewhere, or you are, you know, in Australia or anywhere else in the world, like there is opportunity for inspiration in all around you. And on that same note, though, I wanted to say too that kind of in the name of like getting involved and in the name of inspiration, I think for me, I've personally found a lot of inspiration in like the people and the culture around me and kind of like what's happening in my area. Like I said, I went to a science talk tonight and tomorrow I'm going to this sea slug census. So go nudibranch. We don't have to get into that. But I also will attest to the fact that I've lived in places where those things don't exist. I've lived in places where like I have felt that there isn't a community like that I've wanted to partake in. And if you want to be involved and get involved in those things, if it doesn't exist, and I think empowering yourself, build something and to organize something that you're passionate about and that interests you, if it doesn't exist, go for it. If you're thinking about it and this idea has even crossed your mind and you're like, oh, wow, I feel like I really like this thing to exist. Boom, that idea has called to you. It is now your mission for that thing to come to fruition.
If there is a listener who is like feeling really inspired and is like, I want to do what they do. You know, I want to go down a similar path. I want to have similar experiences. I mean, what would be your advice for, you know, maybe first steps?
Absolutely. Be radically flexible and be open to opportunities that come your way. And for me, I have started fresh, blank slate, more times than I can count. And when I came to Australia, didn't know a soul, didn't come with anybody, didn't have any connections. Came here pretty much, yeah, again, on a whim, thinking I was going to be here for 2 months and ended up putting myself out there. And when I say putting myself out there, what I actually did was ask around folks, look at, if you go to like a cafe or something, look at the little posters that are hanging up on the walls, see what's going on, go to some of those events. There's probably a Facebook group for the area. I've reached out in Facebook groups before and just said, hey, my name's Emily. I really like trees and stuff. Anybody else like trees and stuff? And the number of people who have been like, oh yeah, me, I like trees and stuff. Let's go organize a beach cleanup, or let's go talk about nudibranchs together, or let's go, you know, on a hike. And those connections that I've made just by engaging in the world around me, just by being open to connection, being open to possibilities, is exactly what's gotten me where I am today. It's gotten me the jobs that I've had. It's also gotten me involved in all of the organizations that I've been involved in along the way. So like in each community that I've had a chance to live in. So I tend to like work and live in a place for several months, and then I'll travel to, you know, a little bit down the road, stay there for a bit, travel a little bit, stay there a bit. And each of those places that I've called home or stayed, I've gotten like really involved in whatever local organizations that I've been in. So along the East Coast, up near the Great Barrier Reef, I was involved in this organization called the Keppel Island Environmental Education Center. And the only reason why I got involved with that is because, yeah, I made some posts on Facebook about wanting to get involved with any ocean stuff in the area. And if anyone can point me in the direction of if there's any ocean stuff. I'm pretty sure I literally said that in the Facebook post. And then someone reached out and was like, yeah, I know a gal, pointing me in the direction of like someone who could, you know, connect me to someone else, right? And when I moved down to Tasmania, I was involved with the Bob Brown Foundation. And the only reason I was involved with that is because I happened to tell someone I like their bird sticker on their water bottle. And they're like, oh yeah, I volunteer with the Bob Brown Foundation. You should come on a bird survey with me next weekend. And it's like all of those little things that have happened have evolved into different opportunities. And I would just say like, be open to that. And then also like not being afraid to be the person who starts those things. All of those organizations, all of these ideas and clubs and cleanups and whatever it is that you are
you know, want to be a part of have all started with someone having an idea, and that person can be you.
What a wonderfully put answer. I just want to say,
especially like that last part is like the, you know, like the, all of those things that start with somebody. And I feel like today with all the things going on in the world, even if you just go, let's focus that in on environmentally, the things that are going on in the world or with the climate, it's so easy to be like, wow, that's just too big. I can't play a part. You know, I'm just a person. I'm just one person. You know, it's up to the corporations or, you know, whatever it might be. But people, that's just like our human negativity bias going really, really strong. Like we forget that if you can acknowledge that you have a role in negative impact, you have the potential to have a positive impact, right? If you are saying that me as an individual can contribute to the overall negative, then of course you can contribute to the overall positive. And it just takes, you know, one person acting, one person reaching out to another person, one person setting up a meeting at a local library, you know, whatever it is. And I just appreciate you putting that into better words than I have been able to.
Oh, Danny, that's so sweet.
As far as the future goes, do you have any plans, any upcoming projects, hopes for where the road might take you next?
Oh, man. Hopes for what might happen next. So I am a, what might call a haphazard backpacker, where I like totally have been, you can never plan more than like a month in advance for me. Or like, I feel like ever since COVID kind of scared away the fear of like planning, like the 5-year plan, you know, I have ideas of things that may happen, but plans, I think, just like aren't really on the cards for me. It's more like just kind of going with whatever happens. But I will probably be up here doing my Ningaloo stuff for until November. Yeah, quick reminder, Southern Hemisphere seasons are opposite. So come November time, it's coming into summertime. And I am in a very hot, hot part of Australia. So come November, it's going to get real toasty. And that means I migrate south with the whales. So I will probably head back down to Tasmania and do another season of bushwalk guiding. Possibly on Cradle Mountain Treks, which is an epic, like 6 to 8 day, like overnight backpacking trip in some of Australia's grandest mountains. And by grand, I mean teeny tiny mountains, because it's Australia and they're not renowned for their mountains. But yeah, Mom, if you're listening to this, sorry, but probably I'll be in Australia for another 2 years and then head over to New Zealand as well after that. I've got hopes and aspirations to do the Te Aroha, which is the through hike of New Zealand, eventually, 2026 exclamation point. So all TBD, but definitely pondering and always having some exciting things brewing that, you know, get me excited for life and whatever comes next. Yeah.
Well, awesome. I thank you so much for your time. I know it's like later in the day for you. It's my day is just getting started on this end and stuff. I just genuinely, I very much appreciate your time and your thoughts and your curiosity. Stay in touch. I'm really curious to see kind of what you do next. And again, I really appreciate it.
Right back at you. Honestly, I was so happy when, that reel came across my For You page. And you can probably tell after our interview, like what you're doing with taking all of the sciencey things, and you are being an educator, a communicator, a synthesizer for all of this. Like, at the core of like my deepest passions, I can feel that within you as well. And the fact that you're like teaching and everything on top of doing all of this other stuff, that's like wild and crazy. And I'm like, I don't even want to know what your schedule looks like, bro. Like, that's nuts. But like,
it's hectic.
I can tell, I can, having coral aquarium tanks casually, like there's so many things like I wish we could just chat more just about life. Think again, what you're doing as well, like what this work that we're both really interested in, is so key and it's so inspiring for me to like see other people doing it and embodying it and like bringing these voices to light. And it's just incredible. And more of it. Absolutely, like, cannot wait to see where you go or wildlife goes. And just like, can't believe that I've been able to be a part of it. I feel like, oh, yeah, dream come true. I'm like, you know, guess what? Mom, go crazy. Like, even just like, yeah, the whole idea of it, the concept of it, I applaud to you. And I think thumbs of approval of all of it. Again, so yeah, thanks for doing what you've done and like engaging in the way that you have with the world. I think it's super epic.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Again, Emily, for coming on the show. You have been an absolute inspiration to me, and I'm hoping, I would imagine that you will be an inspiration to people who are listening. And to those of you listening, thank you for also being an inspiration for me to continue creating the show. If you would like to help support the creation of the show, the video series that I do on TikTok and Instagram, like Field Guide of Wonder, my Substack series, like my Climate Communication Toolkit, my Wolf series, Beyond the Count, any of the stuff that I'm doing with science communication education, you can do that at patreon.com for as little as $1 per month. I should probably mention the actual full thing. It's patreon.com/thewildlife. All right. Thanks for listening. Be yourself. Stay curious. And peace out, Rainbow Trouts.
Hello, Devin. Wow, wow, wow. First of all, thank you. I've just finished listening to the podcast and I am just beaming. You did such an amazing job putting that all together. And I'm just giggling at it all. But since then, I have been given a full-time role as a marine and nature guide at Sal Salis, and I'm up here again for my second year. So in the note how I had just said I was only working there for a month and I really wanted to see how the coral has changed over the years. Oh, how that has not aged well. This last summer, we received the largest bleaching event in Ningaloo's history. And I left in November when the corals were healthy, and I came back 2 months later and over half of the reef had bleached. So I bear complete witness to these sites that I was going to every single day had changed dramatically, going from extremely healthy and full of life to, I would say, half of it had bleached. Maybe a third of that coral has since died and been covered with algae. And the remaining kind of fraction of that is either recovering still or has recovered. So it has been pretty harrowing seeing these drastic changes before my own eyes in a mere matter of months. But my goal now is essentially educating people on how corals work. That's been my main focus this year when I take folks out on snorkel tours and talking about, you know, what corals are and what bleaching is and how they're just hungry corals, but they're really vulnerable. And what I've been doing a lot in my free time is volunteering with a Coral Watch volunteer program, which is essentially a group that a mate of mine spearheaded and then I have since joined in on. And we go out and we survey the corals and take these little slates that have a color grade on it from bleached to healthy, and we sample and survey the reef because there's little to no data on the Ningaloo Reef. So we are tracking and observing and monitoring the health of the reef here so that way we can have a sense of how much of it has bleached versus how much of it is healthy and try and collect some data. But that's what I do in my free time now. It's what I volunteer with these days. And then during work, I'm hiking and snorkeling with guests every day. And yes, as far as that bit about the reef and the resiliency of it compared to the Great Barrier Reef is that it's the Lewin Current, or L-E-E-W-I-N, L-E-E-U-W-I-N, Lewin Current, that runs through the Ningaloo, which tends to create a colder swell than the warmer waters that the Great Barrier Reef get. However, As we have found out this last summer, it was the biggest bleaching event since 2008. So it is not as resilient as all the scientists thought. And again, therefore, there's a big lack of data on the Ningaloo, which we're trying to fix that. Anyways, ramble, you rock. And I really enjoyed listening to that podcast. So cheers. I hope you're well, and I'll speak to you soon.